Welcome to another episode of the Conversations for Financials Professionals podcast, where we are shaping the next generation of financial advice. Today, we have Annie and Prima Martin. Annie, you are the owner of One in Prima, where you teach people how to recognize cognitive dissonance and conflict within the body so they can harness that to propel in business and life. You hold a doctorate degree in metaphysics, a graduate level training in positive psychology, and an undergrad in business and associates in criminal justice. You're also a veteran of the armed forces, having served in Kuwait and the Middle East. And I met you through happenstance, actually, on a little known thing called the interwebs, app called Clubhouse. And I was very impressed from the beginning. So welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm going to ask you something that's going to probably be out of left field. So on Instagram TV, I've noticed these Gary V, I guess, advertising he does called overrated and underrated. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
No, tell me more.
He'll throw out a subject and he'll be like, financial coaching, underrated or overrated? And I'm going to throw that to you. I'm like asking, is financial coaching overrated or underrated?
I think it's misunderstood.
Ooh, okay.
Because when we look at coaching in general, right, there's such a flooded market of people calling themselves coaches, financial coaches, business coaches, life coaches, but they're the same people that have not walked the path. Like, I've met more business coaches that have never owned an S Corp. So they've never had to make really, really difficult decisions. And I've met financial coaches, not CFPs, not licensed, right? Unregulated financial coaches that have never even earned $1 million. So, right, I think it's misunderstood because we're not taught the language as young teenagers and such. So when we come in, we don't know the difference between a CFP and a financial coach. We think they're in the same caliber and they're not. So if we understood the language and we spoke the language, we would be able to translate the language better.
Ooh, I love that answer. It almost makes me want to rabbit trail totally from what I was going to ask you next. But no, I think you hit on something really huge, which is this broad umbrella that people, consumers of financial services, paint financial professionals in, like they're one size fit all. And what you're saying, and I totally agree with, they're all different. Like, yeah. From experience, from the specialty, from like the whole nine, everything's a little different and you have to be aware of how to do your own due diligence for what you need.
Yeah, well, when we look at medical field, well, we can freely talk about bad doctors and good doctors. We talk about bad lawyers, good lawyers. We don't talk about good financial right representatives and bad financial representatives. It's just because when I look at finance and how behavioral finance affects, so I specialize in how energy interacts with the human system. So the energy, the essence, from a science side, but also a spiritual side, we don't look at the rules that we have with finance, right? And how finance is, it's more vulnerable to say you have a financial problem than it is to say you have a mental health problem or, you know, a physical problem. We're more hesitant to say, well, you know, I could use a little help here, but we'll go to a doctor when something's wrong because we haven't made it normal to seek advice in this lane because it's so uncomfortable for many people. Like the vulnerability of saying, I screwed up financially, I screwed up and I need help, or I'm way out of my league in understanding this level of financial planning.
I think you're spot on. I think this sets up everything for this psychology of money decisions discussion we're going to have. I would like to frame it in three separate perspectives or themes. Let's first talk about the bondage, because I don't know that you can go anywhere without being released from your slavery of whatever mindset you're in, right? And then we can kind of move to what I would call the freedom after your bondage, and then maybe how do you maintain that, right? So let's stick with bondage, which I think has to start with personal money stories, right? Like, would you disagree with that? What are your thoughts?
No, I absolutely agree, because then that's going into psychology. And we all make decisions based on our psychological well-being, mental well-being, right? So if we're doing things out of fear, we're going to make decisions out of fear financially. What I was taught, I remember in business when I was getting my undergrad, I had an economics teacher and he said, look at money as a reflection of what's going on in your head.
Okay.
How you spend money, what you're buying, that's all a reflection of what's going on in your head. You know, slow and steady students that would study for their tests in increments had very different financial behaviors than the people who crammed in the last minute. So that was a, whoa, you know, I'm in my probably 18, 19 years old thinking, whoa, if we understand that, if we understand our behaviors in our home get reflected in our purchasing patterns, right? That it's all relative. So when I look at bondage and in the money stories, when I come from the perspective of the army, when we would judge good leaders, we didn't judge the good leaders in how they trained their subordinates, the down trace. We looked at what those leaders did in the second generation. Did those leaders train future leaders properly, not just to be leaders themselves, but to then turn and train the next generation? So when I look at money stories from more of the psychological side, is how did your grandparents teach your parents about money? Because those are two different generations showing two different stories. We have to look at both of those generations. Is did our parents good choices or poor choices? Were they because they mimicked what they learned, or is it because they were doing the opposite or they were in survival mode? What caused our grandparents to teach our parents, who then taught us about money?
No, this is really intriguing, because it reminds me of a couple of things. The first thought I had was, my wife has a saying, and this I think draws a parallel to a lot of things, that are amplifiers. Money is an amplifier. It's only going to show you what's inside of you, just like fame or power or notoriety or any of these things. They just amplify what's inside of you. So I'm always hesitant when somebody goes, yeah, I'll give more, I'll do more of this when I get more money. I'm just like, no, that's not how that works. And the other thought was this notion around the order of consequences. So Ray Dalio talks about this in his book, Principles, where you have this first and second and third order consequence. Yeah. And, you know, you might think about working out. The first order consequence is probably you're sore because you haven't done it in a while. You know, the second order consequence will be something like you're starting to feel better, even though people don't notice it. Like, but you look in the mirror and you go, oh, okay. And then the third order consequences is probably somebody walking down the street said, dude, Annie, have you, like, you're looking really good. Like, what are you doing? Were you working out? You know, those are the type of thing, but those take, the second and third order consequences have much greater impact, but they take longer to do. So I want to spin this a little bit, because I love the train that you go down with, you know, how are grandparents teaching my parents versus my parents teaching me? Like, how do people start to uncover that history of their money stories? I mean, because those are difficult conversations.
It's very vulnerable conversations. When we talk about money generationally, then we also have to look at the flaws and the hiccups along the way, the speed bumps that we've hit. And very often, if we didn't come from generations that already had an understanding of money, we then have to also look at guilt and shame. And right? Like that, this is the lane that I play in a lot, is helping people uncover the guilt and the shame. Because people will carry shame on poor financial decisions, even though they, without having the compassion to say, I just didn't have the skill sets at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when I look at my parents and my grandparents, we have to recognize that at the time that they were coming into their adulthood, the world was very different. My grandfather was a product of the Great Depression. You know, he was born in the very early 1900s. So he's coming into adulthood in the Great Depression. So, you know, we had the upper middle class family driving the Cadillacs in the 50s, but he would also like save the paper towels and let them hand dry. and save all the eyewear and like, no, we don't throw those away in case our eyes, it was this, we were enjoying the upper, I wasn't alive. He was enjoying the upper middle class life, but still carrying some of those emotions of lack because, you know, in the Great Depression, he was working probably 20 hours a day just to survive. And then those same habits continued and he was thriving quite well, but what caused him to go into those spaces. And then, my father then picked up on those behaviors, but without the work ethic of working 20 hours because the necessity wasn't there. Yeah. But it was still like this like hoarding, like, oh no, we can't throw this out because what if we don't have it? Even though he didn't live, he wasn't born in the 20s. My grandfather was. So we have to kind of peel back the layers and say, okay, well, let's have a little compassion in the story and then let's change the story.
Why are people so hard on themselves when it comes to this with not letting what I would say, my saying is, let a little air out the tire. Like, why are people so hard on themselves when it comes to money? And I'm a give you a part B to that. Is it because of the where we're at right now, where it's this, this postmodern consumerism, which I don't have, I don't have anything about capitalism. I'm fine. But the point is, like this comparison of the Joneses or keeping up with the Joneses, does that play into it? Like, why are people so hard on themselves?
Well, peer pressure. A lot of it is peer pressure, right? So anyone goes out and buys the $10 million house, right? The neighbor that owns the $9 million house then wants the $10.5 million house, right? And we start playing this game, even if it, and this popped in my head because I have a client who has, she bought a giant house. She does very well, but she's so unhappy in this giant house. And then why don't you move into a little house? Well, then what are they going to think of me? Like, it doesn't matter if you're not happy in this giant house and that giant house is not happy with you in it because you're never there. Why are you living in the giant house?
Yeah.
And we get in this mentality, what will people think of me? The external of I won't feel worthy if they don't see me as equal to them in the financial realm. So then we see people who certainly can't afford higher end vehicles and higher end, whatever, phones, purses, whatever that may be, wanting to keep up in this mentality, even though those things don't make them happy, they're just stuff. We have to first come back to recognizing why we're caught up in this. Why are we in this competition to begin with? Why are we in this game? Is this even a game we want to play?
Yeah. No, and I would say, at least my anecdote to that would be what I would start asking the type of questions like, what do you feel about yourself? Like, what are the things that you value? Because my deal has always been in what I call more of a life planning deal is taking your time, talent, and treasure, your actual tangible resources, and overlapping those with what you value and believe, because you're gonna get more financial contentment. You're gonna get more bang for your buck because those things can't be mutually exclusive. People try to live their lives and separate those two, but it never happens. And the more that you understand that those two things, like a Venn diagram, need to have overlap, the better. I say, whether you have whatever your standard of living is, the point is people that create more overlap between those two dynamics generally have a happier life. And so I just wonder in your opinion, when do people, or how do people rather, start to do the type of self-work that opens that up? And I guess we can kind of segue this into the freedom talk now from that bondage.
Yeah, we have to first recognize that the overlap is really like, when I see it, because I think in playful terms, it's like, it's dance partners. Sometimes one is leading, the other one's leading, right? And it's this ebb and flow in motion. And we have to recognize, just like with, when I'm working with, mind, body, spirit, and people are so quick to like, want to push the ego out of the side. It's like, no, we have to co-pilot. There has to be a balance. So with the freedom, we have to also have compassion. So going back to the question of why are people so hard on themselves is why are they so hard on themselves in other arenas as well? Where's the compassion for the learning journey?
Mm. Does that fall into the, I mean, I can almost maybe substitute a term there is patience, like patience. With yourself.
Yeah.
Like why are we trying to do, you know, I talked to somebody the other day about, you know, the career change and getting into this industry. And they were like, yeah, you know, I got to hurry up because I just had a kid and I'm 30. I'm like, 30?
Right.
Like, dude, you got a lot of time. So, you know, I think, you know, some of the world, the way it changes so quickly, whether it be technology or whatever, tends to rush us when we maybe need to be taking all areas of our life, including our money story, and just smelling the roses a little bit more.
Yeah, walking in the messy middle. And in our culture, it's okay, go buy that big stock that's going to make you $1 million tomorrow, right? Like it's this get rich quick mentality. And we forget how important that messy middle is, the learning curve, that bell curve. We want to skip over the patience part. And we don't realize that in that patience part, we're kind of learning as we go. We're gaining the intelligence, we're gaining the wisdom, the financial savviness and sophistication that allows us to make smarter decisions at a greater scale. And we miss out on that if we try to jump that messy middle. So
does everybody have a messy middle that they have to go through in your experience?
I haven't met anyone who doesn't, right? Like that's part of the story, isn't it? It's like where we're going, where we are and where we're going to be. If we skip over, if I were to ask you.
Yeah.
Once you got your licensure, the CFP licensure, right? Have you not learned anything between then and now? Was it empty?
No, you're right. I mean, and even I tell people all the time, I mean, like with not pushing the envelope, but changing gears just a second, but it's like, don't rush into just trying to get the CFP either. I just had a conversation today. I'm like, I was in the industry for 15 years before CFP happened. And I'm like, it gave me enough time to sample the different aspects of this industry to see where my superpower lied, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, a lot of people rush into what I should be doing. And I think it has to do with this. At the end of the day, and I listened to this artist, and he has a song lyric that goes like this: comparison kills. If we take too much time looking around at what everybody else is doing, we're killing ourselves.
Yeah.
Like, and I think I'm underscoring that point because I think that's what you're saying when it comes to these money stories and how people are really just not staying in their own lane when it comes to reaching their goals for their money.
Yeah. If we're looking left and right, we're not mastering our own lane. Mm. You can't focus on what you're really good at if you're concerned with what everybody else is doing. And even in a competitive business arena, you still have to, like the business owners, the founders have to still master their lane. And if they keep trying to jump and do what the others are doing without understanding why they're doing it, they're going to fail.
No, I totally agree with that. And I think that's why it's so key. You know, I talk to aspiring financial professionals all the time and I'm like, they say, hey, I want to get into the industry. Fine. Why?
Why?
Well, I'm like, okay, go back to the drawing board. If you're here because of the big, you know, remuneration you can make, that's great. You can make a lot of money, but that will not last you for the bell curve that you're talking about or referring to when things get hard, because you're going to hear way more no's, especially up front, than you will ever hear yeses. And you've got to have a motivation that I think puts you in a spot where you feel you're a servant leader to people that need a guide to their financial destination. If you don't look at it that way, It's over for you.
And what is the Peter Parker principle? With great power comes great responsibility.
Yes.
To be in that position, acknowledge the degree of responsibility that comes with it.
Yeah.
And there's a level of maturity that has to happen. I don't give financial advice because I don't want the responsibility of giving someone financial advice. Someone else has the calling for that. Right. So it's going back to understanding how to translate the language. Mm-hmm. Circling back to the beginning, is the people that are offering financial coaching advice, are they in a position to hold the responsibility for what they say?
Yeah.
And that's wisdom.
Let's unpack that a bit, because I want to ask, you know, from what you understand and what you do, I think you can speak to this. I don't know that a lot of financial professionals, you know, well, first of all, I know a lot of financial professionals are not trained as coaches to coach their clients. This is a definitely developed skill. I haven't been trained as a coach formally, but I've just been married for 23 years and I have three kids. So,
right. That's the messy middle. The messy middle. Got you there.
I get it a little bit. I get it, right? But at the same time, there's a difference between a coach, a therapist. If you don't mind it, I would say that you probably fall more in that middle of the therapist. And then there's the planner advisor, like kind of break those down and correct me if I'm wrong with what you do.
So I'm not quite a coach, but I would lean more toward coaching only because when we use the word like counselor or therapist, that carries a lot more responsibility.
Okay.
With mental health and mental well-being, where a coach is really asking questions. And, you know, with my particular set of skills, I mind, body, spirit is three voices. So even with atheists, it's not mind, body, soul, mind, body, essence. And we all have energy that's measurable, that's scientific. I recognize them as three voices because the body will say things that the mind disagrees, that cognitive dissonance, the actions disagree with belief systems. So in coaching, I'm looking at all three and in treating it like, well, here are some questions. If I'm working with a client, let me ask some questions. Let's peel back the layers through questions, and they're open, and the individual is carrying the responsibility for their choices.
I think that's key. I've read this several times. I have a great friend that has her own financial coaching certification that she trains people through. And I think that's the key task, if you will, under a coach, is where the responsibility is on the individual to do the work versus the professional, you know, taking 100% of the responsibility to say, hey, here's your investment allocation. Here's the plan. Here's the, you know, everything's not emanating from us. It seems like in the coaching situation, from what I understand, the solution is emanating with the client. Is that correct?
Yeah. Like bumpers on a bowling alley. It's kind of just nudging people to get to the destination on their own. Where in therapy, you have the therapist, the counselor would have they know where they're going and they're taking the person there. Through questions, right? It's a very typically a guided path. But then when we look at like planners and advisors, that's the planner advisors carrying the responsibility because they're giving advice that's being taken as fact, where a coach is not giving advice taken as fact. It's really just prompting questions for the person to arrive there on their own.
No, I like that. That's a good distinction. So
you know, where on the scale is the responsibility?
Yeah. Coaching. Now, that's probably a topic that you either know you needed or you don't. So I'm not here to tell you that you need a coach. However, what I will tell you is that as an existing financial professional, sometimes you might find yourself a little inconsistent or even frustrated when you compare your success to those of your peers. That's because you have more in you, my friend. You got more to pull out. You got some more potential. Enter the Masterclass Coaching Lab. Having consulted some of the top advisors over the past few years, including building my own wealth management firm, I know what it takes to take you and your team to the next level. So as one of my coaching clients, we're gonna have a no-fluff, customized plan to absolutely crush your goals. No BS, no fluff. Need to break away and start your own firm? Got you covered. Need to find your ideal client? Got you covered. Maybe you need help finding that ideal client or implementing some ROI producing systems and workflows. Got you covered. In either case, the Masterclass Coaching Lab is probably for you. Look, if you're serious about getting to the next level and you need some assistance, all you need to do is go to thejumpstartcoachinglab.com/masterclass and get started with your application. Let's get back to that episode. I don't know how much you keep up on industry stuff, but I'm curious, is your opinion of this next generation financial professional? Because you may or may not disagree with the statement, but I kind of feel like financial services has hit a couple of phases. And the phase we're in right now is so much more consumer driven, where they are dictating the type of interaction, the type of engagement they want from financial professionals. It didn't used to be that 25 years ago. I mean, for the most part, you know, the practitioner dictated that or the professional did. What are your thoughts around the type of skill set that a financial professional needs to have, regardless of what you specialize in, whether that's investment advice or coaching or whatever. Talk about some of those skill sets that you think are the most important.
I want to back up a little bit because I want to recognize sort of the behavior, the generational changes, right? We used to go to a doctor and take the doctor's full advice. Mm-hmm. And then the doctor started carrying more liability and they didn't want the liability and the responsibility, right? Lawsuits and whatnot. So now they're like, okay, patient, you tell me what you want. I'll write the script, right? Mm. We irresponsibly gave the power to the patient and we lifted the power collectively from ourselves. We see this with divorce lawyers. Tell me what you want. I'm not going to tell you what is in an arbitration or mediation viewpoint perspective. Tell me what you want. We're going to fight for that. Not this is really what's in the greatest good for the family as it's separating. And we do that in finance. We've seen that in finances too, where people now have access to their own trading platforms and their own, they can do things on their own. But again, there's no messy middle to have learned how to make the smarter decisions in the middle.
Let's pause right there. I think you're bringing up a really good point. I'm glad you brought this, you went down this lane. So, you know, we have the ERISA Act of 74, I believe, that basically changed the landscape of defined benefit or pension plans, as everybody knew, to defined contributions, which was a major shift because what you did is essentially is take the responsibility from corporations for providing for the financial well-being of their former employees to the employee. Like we were like, hey, you go invest in your own 401k. It's like, well, I had no financial literacy or it doesn't matter. It's not my responsibility anymore. You know? So, you know, that's where I would say a lot of, and I don't know if this is always acknowledged, but that's where the need for financial advice really came. And that's where this industry really started to capitalize on the fact that people are now forced to invest for themselves so that they have a retirement future. And some people didn't want to do that on their own. So we had this whole, you know, creeping into the 401k space to provide advice. So to your point, this is the shift of responsibility, I would say. And I want to ask you, is that a good thing? I don't know. Like I'm wondering in certain arenas, I can see how that might be good, but in financial advice, I don't know so much that it is that good.
Two things popped in my head. One, we're coming from a world, a generation now that checks out their own groceries at a supermarket. Or has it delivered, right? Zero effort on the end of the company to provide people who understand the SKUs of produce, right?
Yeah.
But then what is that saying with lawyers? A lawyer who represents himself as a fool for a client. And that's why how I see finances is if you don't have the experience of the messy middle, why are you taking this on yourself when really for a small fee, you know, small investment, you're getting the wisdom of someone that knows how to move the chess pieces on the board game to get the end result, to win this game.
No, you raise a good point. I think it all matters how you value that part of your life, right? So I think the bias, including myself, which is the reason why I have, you know, a personality used to, is that, you know, when I make the money, when I spend the money, when I, you know, all that, you know, gives me the notion that I know what best to do with it. And I'm in the game for two decades at this point, but this thing about the average consumer that has not, you know, taken financial literacy, they say, oh, I can go invest low cost, you know, index funds. Okay. That's investments. What about the financial plan? What about the risk management? What about the, you know, all the other stuff that goes into a relationship? I think there is a bias that says I made the money. I know what best to do with it, which is just false. It's a false narrative that people buy into. That, you know, you can take as much education there is as possible, but sometimes it takes an outside perspective from a professional that has no skin in the game, but just to tell you, that's wrong.
Objective.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's an old proverb. It says you can't see the label from inside your own jar.
Ooh, I love that. Oh, you've given me a couple of good sound bites in this conversation. Thank you. I appreciate it.
if we have our own muddled mess and we're not aware of it, we're not consciously aware of it until someone brings it to our attention, right? So our own biases don't get reflected back to us until someone presents a way for us to see it and mirror it back. So even with our finances, we're making decisions, and I've done it myself.
Yeah.
Where I made decisions like, if somebody had come in and said, "Hey, that's not going to be the smartest move. Let me give you just a different perspective for a moment." Mm-hmm. That would have saved me a lot of tears.
Yeah. No, I think so. When we think about just the intersection of consumers and providers of financial services, where somebody hires somebody, I think we have to look, at least from the consumer standpoint, they have to look beyond just the broker's statement of, here's my returns, here's my fees. Okay, did that make sense? It's a little bit more complicated than that. So I guess what I would want to ask is, where do you feel the role of coaching, financial advice, financial therapy plays in the, let's call it the life cycle of a person? Are you of the persuasion that most people, if not all, are probably going to need somebody in their life during their life?
Yeah, the smartest people I know, and I'm talking smart, like 8-figure, 9-figure
yeah,
net worth, all have, they got there on their own and they're like, I know I'm smart enough, but I'm smart enough to know where I have my own biases. So these folks have financial planners and they have financial advice coming to them to help them make more money. So the smartest people I know, the ones that have bowling alleys in their homes in Las Vegas, are the ones that say, you know what? I want a different perspective to make the smartest choice possible.
Yeah, I love that. Cause I was working with a client and he said, Dominic, I want you to help me make the bigger, better decision.
The bigger, better decision, perfect.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's weird because I know a lot of people that quantify, and I always try to reframe this in all respect with my prospective clients that I deal with. And I'm like, if you're measuring the value of this relationship strictly on the returns in your account minus my fee, you're missing out on a lot. Because like
missing out on the whole journey.
Yeah, because like you said, to make more money, typically the person that is the 8-9 figures net worth, the way they make more money is not necessarily going to be through their investment strategy. That's kind of how they're going to maintain their wealth, but they're probably going to go back to their specialization, whatever that's real estate or whatever. And you're allowing them with good financial advice. The role of a good financial professional is to take that offload from them, that they don't have to think about that anymore, and they can go do what they do, which is their superpower, and so that they can free up more time to make that money or use you as leverage through the wisdom that you bring into the conversation.
That's a powerful point. And I use it but a little bit differently, the analogy of when we look at Bill Gates, when we looked at Einstein, when we looked at Steve Jobs, when we look at Simon Cowell, any of the people that have high profiles, Mark Zuckerberg, they wear the same clothes and they're wearing the same category of clothes because it's one less decision they have to make on something that doesn't make them money. And when we start to peel back, and this was something I had to learn, I'm still learning, I'm very much in this learning, in the learning curve of it. The fewer decisions I make that have no value gives me more space for decisions that have value. And so if somebody else can come in and they're really good at those decisions because that's what they do, then that's where we as the recipient of the support, the financial support, the recipient, now I don't have to worry about focusing on this. I can focus on my lane and grow my lane and diversify my lane.
No, I love that you say that. I'm going to flip it for people out there and use another analogy. You know, towards the end of last year, I was still doing everything on my own, running 2 businesses, all the other kind of stuff. And I finally caved. And this really wasn't a revenue issue as much as it was a control issue.
Yeah.
That I just had to get out of my head that I am not the person that can do everything the right way. There are other people that their zone of genius is my zone of competence or zone of incompetence. So it's like, let them do it. And it's been the most freeing thing. And like, you know, granted, you might go, oh, well, Dom, you know, on your financial statement, that line item that could be in your pocket. But it's like, dude, I value my time more than I value money. So like that free up has been huge for me. And I think people need to be thinking about financial advice the same way. We do. It sounds like you
agree. Yes. If we want more money, we have to make space for more money in our heads.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I think that, so let's unpack that real quick before we talk a little bit more about what you do specifically and how people can work with you. There's this notion around mindset that I have that pretty much means that mindset dictates everything.
I mean, our mind is headquarters to everything we do. It's headquarters to our reality.
Yeah, I'm like 99.9% it's mindset. You know, and we can go into a whole nother podcast on that. But what I want to say with that, to set that up, is to say that, you know, there is this notion around that I hear with people, they act like they're going to come into wealth or money or more finances without changing their mindset. And you just said something that is so key. And I think it dovetails right into this, which is you got to make space first for what you're wanting to receive before it comes to you. Otherwise, it's not coming.
No,
I love that the way you put that is to make space, because you got to make space for, just like me, I was like, okay, I'm gonna make space for the fact that I need help in my business. I can't do everything. And as I made space, then the person appeared. Like I knew what I was looking for. I got clear about it, you know, and all that kind of stuff happened. And then, yeah, it hasn't been the smoothest transition, but it's working. And I think the making space statement you just said is huge for everything in life that we're trying to bring to us.
Yeah, that's one of the core shifts in manifesting. Is making, if you have a full house with full furniture, there is no room for that, for the new sofa that you want. You got to get rid of the sofa to put the new sofa in, right? The new bed that you want, the new car in the garage, whatever it may be. If there's no space for it, where are you going to put it?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. This is, it's so funny. I clean out my closet like every 90 days or so. And I always go through stuff. Like I'll have suits. I don't wear suits anymore. So I always give like two away. Like I'll just give them away. Cause I'm like, I don't need these. Like somebody else could be using these. And no doubt, like, you know, something not necessarily from a clothes standpoint, but something comes in, no doubt, all the time. Because the principle, I'm not even really consciously, you know, doing it. It's more of an unconscious thing now. But I think you bring up a good point where we just need to unconsciously free up space and just clear the clutter that's in our lives. Let's talk about, I think there's a perfect segue. How do you help people clear the clutter, Annie?
So I look, and I use the term metaphysical, but not in crystals and sage, although I enjoy those things too, but it's more of recognizing that we're a human computer system and there's a motherboard. And if we look at our motherboard being our heart, not our brain, because we can survive, we can be brain dead and still survive, right? But if the heart goes down, we're done.
Yeah.
So I look at the energetic system that stems from the heart, and then how do all of the traumas, the emotions, the beliefs, how do all of those things play as software? And the trauma is in a sense like a corruption to the hardware system. So how do we go and repair those lines? So when I'm working with people, whether in a coaching or a biofield scanning system, like looking for heat signatures in their system. So, and I'll give an example, like especially women that have thyroid issues almost always had childhoods where they didn't have a voice. The voice was shut down, or their opinion didn't matter, or they weren't allowed to speak, and it builds up and builds up and builds up. So the physical manifestation, so I look at how do we peel back that faulty wiring and rewire new things, and then input new software. So the biohacking, in a sense, in the bioscience of it, and then recognize that the neuroanatomy, the brain, has a lot of power. And if we learn how to use each piece of our brain, we can produce a different outcome. So it's a lot of like fun stuff, even though it doesn't sound quite as fun. It's a lot of fun in someone taking that journey and recognizing who they are at the core when all those lines are flushed and clean.
No, that's a good, it's funny that you're saying that, because I had an idea about how you may practice, but I had no idea how strong a corollary it is to something I've been developing over like the last 5 years, which is this pyramid that looks like Maslow hierarchy of needs. And we have our belief system that underlies pretty much everything. We have our experiences, which we can't change, but we can definitely change the way we think about what has happened to us.
The physiological response to them.
Yes, because and then we take that belief system, which basically informs how we behave, how we act, what we do, which then gives us results. So I always tell my clients, I'm like, if you feel like your results are, you know, leading you into bondage, then we need to reevaluate what you do. But ultimately, we need to reevaluate how you think, because if you're thinking the wrong way, then you're going to stay in bondage. So your results come from that. It sounds very, very similar overlap, and is at least for the mindset that I try to use to free people from where they're currently at.
Yeah. And then if we look at that same pyramid, and, you know, being in Las Vegas, my analogies are going to be very, the Luxor pyramid that has that giant light shooting out of it that can be seen from the sky, is once we move up that pyramid, when we get to that top, we're operating in what I call light space, where we are just so optimized and we're so efficient in our decision-making that we're manifesting things, not necessarily in a mystical way, but we've got everything in alignment that our decisions are really strong and smart.
Yeah. No, I love that. I love that. How can, well, I guess we'll leave in the show notes how everybody can get in contact with you if they want to reach out. This has been so great. I feel like I can go literally like a whole nother hour or two with you on all these rabbit trails that we started. People are going to want to have to, they're just going to have to reach out to you. So this is a podcast, as you know, to help empower tomorrow's financial professional with tools to serve their ideal client at the next level. In that context, what word or words of wisdom would you leave with them, Annie?
Wisdom. Keep seeking wisdom, because it doesn't matter how long someone's been in their lane. I've been driving a vehicle for 30 years. I'm still an average driver, right? But if I put all my attention on becoming a better driver, I could go do NASCAR, right? That's feasible. If we keep focusing on our lane as professionals and keep sharpening, keep refining, keep extending the wisdom in that lane, that's the best we can do to serve humanity.
No, I think you're right. I mean, you look at the top 1% of the 1% that, you know, a list of people that you started earlier, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Warren Buffett, all these people have really gotten laser focused on what they feel is their best. And they almost purely operate in their zone of genius.
Yeah. And they didn't stop learning. They're still learning, even though they're billionaires.
Yeah.
They're still seeking knowledge. There's so much out there that we're not going. The reality is, we can get to the very end of the last day of our life and still not have learned everything there is in our lane. But we can try to get there.
No, I think you're right. You're saying to do that, to go on that pursuit, to go on that quest is the highest and best use for our ideal clients in this particular industry. I couldn't agree with that anymore. This
shows respect for our clients too, that, hey, I know that I can be a better provider, a better financial provider to you by me continuing to seek wisdom.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, no argument there. No argument there. Excuse me. Well, Annie, this has been great. I will let you get to the rest of your day. Thank you for spending some time with us and sharing your wisdom on this subject of psychology of money decisions.
Yeah, Dominique, this was my pleasure. Thank you so much. And it was an honor for me to be here.
Absolutely. Take care. Bye-bye. Hey there, I really hope you enjoyed this conversation. Before we go, just a few things. The best way to retain what you just learned is to do more than just listen. First, you need to write down your most important takeaway, and then you need to give yourself a deadline to apply it. For bonus points, you might also let someone hold you accountable to that deadline. Also, remember the only way more people will know about this podcast is if you share it. You can do that by sharing a link to this episode on your social media or by leaving a review on iTunes so that it reaches a wider audience. I'd appreciate if you took the time to do either or both. And finally, if you'd like to join my free community to learn more about how you can become a next generation financial professional, please text me at 214-544-9226. I'd love to hear from you and point you in the right direction. Bye for now, until our next conversation.